From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. An enormous science lab was launched into space this week. It will be the main research center of the new International Space Station. Meanwhile, the Russian space station Mir is scheduled to return to Earth in early March. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with retired American astronaut Jerry Lininger about spending 5 months aboard the dark, cluttered, smelly, and deteriorating Mir as part of a joint U.S.-Russian mission. Also, Anthony Hopkins talks about portraying the cannibalistic killer Dr. Hannibal Lecter. Hopkins is now starring in Hannibal, the sequel to Silence of the Lambs. How do the two films compare? Henry Sheehan has a review of Hannibal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell says the Bush administration remains committed to building a national missile defense, but is not rushing into it. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Powell argues a missile defense system will strengthen deterrence and be a stabilizing factor.
There are nations on Earth who are developing these weapons that can threaten their neighbors and can threaten us, and it would be irresponsible of us not to move forward with technologies that have the possibility of being able to stop these kinds of weapons.
Powell, though, did stress it will take time as the Bush administration studies the possibilities for a national missile defense. In the meantime, he promised to consult with critics of the plan, including Russia and some European allies. The issue will likely be high on the agenda when Powell goes to Brussels for a NATO foreign ministers meeting later this month. During his first solo foreign trip as Secretary of State, Powell may also meet with Russia's foreign minister. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Colombia and its biggest rebel group have agreed to resume peace negotiations. President Andres Pastrana and rebel leader Manuel Marulanda issued a joint statement saying that talks begin next Wednesday. Marulanda's group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, has been fighting the government for 37 years. The agreement calls for the two sides to work toward a ceasefire, find a way to exchange prisoners, and invite friendly countries to help with the negotiations. More than 35,000 civilians have died in the violence over the past 10 years. Security police in Iran clashed with several hundred anti-government protesters today on the eve of the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
Iranian police fired tear gas and beat protesters as hundreds chanted, "Freedom of thought forever." They carried sacrilegious banners inscribed with the words, "We are against the Islamic regime." But battalions of riot police and club-wielding Islamic militiamen charged at the crowd, meeting at a popular North Tehran park. Witnesses said the Islamic vigilantes dragged many protesters behind police lines where they beat them up before herding them onto buses. The rally is said to have been called by exiled Iranian opposition groups through radio broadcasts from abroad. Two strong explosions also took place in the same area on Thursday night, but there has been no official comment on the blast and no claim of responsibility. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
The man convicted of killing the son of entertainer Bill Cosby has admitted his guilt. Authorities in Los Angeles have released a letter from Mikhail Markusev in which he admitted the murder of 27-year-old Ennis Cosby in 1997. Markusev has said he's dropping his appeal and he apologized to Cosby's family. He's already serving a life sentence for the crime. The Dow lost 99 points or 0.9% today to close at 10,781. This is NPR. The space shuttle Atlantis linked up with the International Space Station today, ready to attach a new laboratory module to the three-room orbiter. Astronauts will have to lift the $1.4 billion module from the cargo bay using the shuttle's arm. Because the 28-foot module takes up virtually all the room in the bay, astronaut Marsha Ivins will have only about 2 inches of clearance as she lifts it out. Crew members will attach the module to the space station during 3 planned spacewalks tomorrow. Philadelphia police are blaming a sharp increase in stolen cars on teenagers, copying scenes from a newly released video of an action movie. Dave Heller reports from member station WHYY.
Philadelphia Police Captain Thomas Healy says auto thefts are up nearly 50% so far this year in the northeast section of the city. Authorities say kids are imitating aspects of the film Gone in 60 Seconds. Based on it, he says young teens have developed a game in which they steal a car and then drive by a corner where their friends are hanging out. Kids accrue points based on the cars they've stolen. Healy says the cars are usually found nearby. Officials plan to meet with prosecutors next week to plot a get-tough strategy to stop the activity, often carried out by kids too young to obtain licenses. For NPR News, I'm Dave Heller in Philadelphia.
The New York Yankees have signed all-star shortstop Derek Jeter to a 10-year contract worth $189 million. The agreement came after more than a year of negotiations. The deal is the second biggest in sport history, exceeded only by a $252 million contract reached in December between shortstop Alex Rodriguez and the Texas Rangers. This is NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. www.pewtrusts.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the Space Shuttle Atlantis docked at the new International Space Station. The Atlantis carried a giant American science laboratory that will serve as the main control center and research facility of the space station. Meanwhile, the Russian space station Mir, which has been in orbit for nearly 15 years, is scheduled to be brought back to Earth in early March. Jerry Lininger is a retired American astronaut who spent 5 months aboard Mir in 1997. He says it wasn't easy. The space station was in a state of deterioration, communication with Russian ground control was terrible, and something was always going wrong. Lininger's presence on Mir was part of a cooperative mission between the U.S. and Russians to lay the groundwork for an international space station. He was the only American on board and had to get by with his minimal skills speaking Russian. His book about his experience on Mir, Off the Planet, has just come out in paperback. Lininger was taken to the space station by the U.S. space shuttle Atlantis. Last year, I asked him to describe what it looked like inside Mir.
You know, when we first flew into Mir, I got admitted, compared to the shuttle, it had sort of the feel of going into your grandmother's cellar down the basement, sort of a moldy smell to it, a little bit darkened. Electrical power on Mir is always at a premium, and therefore not many lights are on. So it was very cramped and, I guess, claustrophobic feeling. I'm pretty good about not getting claustrophobic myself, so I can't say that it hit me that way. But it definitely hit me as a very confining, dark, damp sort of atmosphere when you fly into Mir.
And it also looks like, from the photos, like there's wires all over the place.
There's a lot of dangling. It's about, at this stage, about a 14-year-old space station. And just like a home that maybe wasn't wired correctly at the beginning, as you add on and put on new modules and new equipment, you need to run extension cords and wire cables and air ducts to blow the to keep the circulation going. So it's a bag of spaghetti up there, lots of wires and lots of possible mistakes is what that creates. Also, the cluttered effect up there can get you into trouble.
What did space smell like, look like, taste like, sound
like? Space, I'll tell you, when you fly into Mir, it smelled like sort of like dirty sweat socks in a guy's locker room. Actual smell of space, so that's a very interesting question. When we would open a hatch, for example, that was exposed to the vacuum of space, there's always a double hatch. And so you open the one hatch, you now have the pure smell of space. And it's a tough, you know, as any aroma is tough to describe, but it has a distinct smell, and it's sort of a burned out after the fire the next morning in your fireplace sort of smell. And that's the real smell of the vacuum of space. And it was very distinctive. After we'd get through that hatch and open the next hatch, for example, if it was a resupply ship that just came up, you'd get the smell of fresh lemons, and that would just go through the air, and it was just an incredible contrast to that sock smell, dirty sock smell, or the burned out smell of the vacuum of space. And then you get this smell of the earth.
Does space have a sound?
When you're out there, for example, during a spacewalk, it is utter silence. It's a vacuum. Sound doesn't conduct. The sound of inside Space Station Mir was one of a factory almost, with lots of turning equipment, noise level very high. And when we lost electrical power and moved to the dark side of the Earth, and everything ground to a halt, and we started spinning through space, tumbling sort of out of control, the silence was just deafening, and a scary silence, I might add. I mean, so silent that it's just scary.
How long did that go on for?
We had some power problems, and that went on, took us about 2 days to recover from that, and every time you'd move to the dark side of the Earth, it was darkness like you've never seen and silence that was scary. We worked with flashlights, eventually regained power.
What was the typical day like, if there is such thing as a typical day, on board the spaceship Mir?
There wasn't many typical days. At the beginning, though, the way it worked, an alarm would go off in the morning, and you'd have to check your watch immediately to make sure it was not a master alarm and rather just a morning wake-up call. That was usually around 8 o'clock, so sort of leisurely, if you will, but you never got to bed before usually 1 in the morning. You know, you'd get up and do your daily tasks of living, a little bit different and unique in space, of course, and go down and suck down a tube of dehydrated borscht or, you know, mashed potatoes or some strange breakfast foods, and then you'd get to work. You'd check a schedule. And you were working from day to night, essentially trying to do experiments and also trying to keep up with the repairs that needed to be done to keep the space station alive. You'd go to bed at night exhausted. I'd strap myself to the wall. I used to sleep upside down on the wall, piece of Velcro around me, close my eyes, and I'd sleep like a baby.
What were some of the experiments you had to carry out?
Had about 120 different experiments, looked at a lot of microbial sampling around Mir to see of any contamination, to see if I, for example, introduced any new bacteria to the space station with my arrival. A lot of protein crystal growth experiments, metallurgy, melting samples, trying to get very pure alloys, because up there, of course, you don't have the problem of settling of the heavier elements down to the bottom, and you get a very pure alloy. You know, grew wheat up there, trying to look to the future of when you do space travel long distances and long periods of time. Just fascinating experiments, really, that really kept you hopping.
Let's get back to how you slept. You slept upside down, attached to...
Slept upside down, inverted, you know, a piece of Velcro around me. And the reason I did that is because it was a good fan on the floor. In space, warm air doesn't rise. There's no convection current. And so you have to have a fan to move the atmosphere around, or you will breathe yourself into an oxygen-depleted and carbon dioxide-rich bubble, and you'll wake up with a severe headache, hyperventilating, gasping for air. So I would sleep inverted, a piece of Velcro around me, just sort of dangle on the wall with a fan blowing in my face.
Did you sleep well in a gravity-free environment?
I slept pretty well. There was actually some sleep experiments I was doing. I had an eye sensor on, for example, look at my rapid eye movement sleep. I had electrodes on my head most nights. And if you looked at my sleep patterns, as the mission progressed, I was having less and less deep sleep and much more rapid eye movement sleep. And I would say on the last month of that five-month mission, I would wake up feeling very tired, and my sleep quality was going downhill.
Do you think it was stress and anxiety or something related to the atmosphere?
No, I think it has to do actually with your biorhythms, losing their sense of day and night. And in space, you're around the planet every 90 minutes, and every 45 minutes, you're getting a sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset. And so you're going through about 15 of those a day. Your body has a very hard time setting the biorhythm, and you start drifting from your Earth-linked biorhythms of a 24-hour day. You know, even the concept of time, when you think about it, it's an amazing world up there. We live in 24 hours in a day down here. You get up in space and you realize that that is an artificial thing that we've created because we're Earthlings. You get in space with in orbit every 90 minutes and you realize 24 hours is meaningless with day-night cycles every, you know, 45 minutes.
One of the things that I found really interesting is that you were expected to recycle urine for water.
it's a closed ecosystem, and you need to recycle everything you can. We would take our urine, collect it using basically a fan device, some valves, close the valve down. We'd take the urine, convert it to water. We'd be called by Mission Control Moscow to say, drink that water, it's good stuff. And we'd say, yeah, you drink it, we don't want to drink it, that's our urine. And instead we would take the water, H2O, split the hydrogen off. What's left over is oxygen. We'd vent the hydrogen to space. That's an explosive gas, don't want that around. And we'd breathe the oxygen. So essentially it's, your urine to water, water to oxygen, and essentially you breathe your urine up on Space Station Mir.
It does sound better than drinking it.
I've drunk a lot of bad things, and I've gone through Navy jungle survival school and eaten snakes and roots and everything else. And, I finally convinced myself, I can drink my urine to be an astronaut, but I could not drink anyone else's urine. And the cosmonauts felt much the same way, and we decided we would use that urine water to make oxygen. We would, though, use some sweat water, if you will. When you run on the treadmill, you perspire, and that would get into the atmosphere. We'd condense that water, purify it, and use some of that water for rehydrating our foods.
My guest is retired American astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is retired American astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir as part of a joint Russian-American mission. You studied the psychology of isolation, and you worked in isolated environments for a long time. You were in the Navy for about 20 years, so you've worked on ships, you've worked on deserted islands, so you knew something about isolation. Describe how isolation in space is different from what you ever faced in the Navy.
I try to prepare myself, and I'll tell you, past life experiences are what helps you out to get through new experiences like being out in space and being a spaceman. But nothing I had done, living on islands or going out to sea on a submarine or any of those past life experiences really prepared me for that profound isolation. And I'll tell you, it was a 5-month test for me, seeing if I had the right stuff, if I could hold up, stay efficient, work hard.
Did you go through any bad depressions?
I did not. I did observe some people that had serious, what I'd call clinical depression up there. It is a psychological battle. My game plan, I watched someone that we overlapped with, one of the cosmonauts, who looked like he had held up well, and he was at the end of his 5th month of stay on Mir, and I tried to mimic him for the first few months. And the main thing I learned is to try to stick to a schedule, try to stay, for example, on Earth time, go to bed at midnight in Moscow, even though it was meaningless up there, exercise religiously, try to keep some routine in your life. When I'd run on the treadmill, I'd have my CD playing, and I'd close my eyes and visualize myself back on Earth, sort of running through my old favorite routes to sort of escape. And during those moments, some great things happened too. I could feel the presence of my dad there with me. He's deceased. He's there with Uncle Bill. They told me they're proud of what I'm doing. So anyway, you do what you can to sort of escape, meditate, if you will, and get away from that shock of isolation.
It surprised me. You say the space station Mir had a good bar, and that although you didn't partake, that the two Russian cosmonauts, did a fair amount of drinking. It's against NASA rules to drink while on the job, but you say you also didn't want to diminish your senses in any way when when anything could happen. But I was surprised to hear that they did drink.
They have a smuggling operation that sort of, everyone knows it's happening when they sort of ignore it. But they, for example, when I unloaded my spacesuit, I was going to do a spacewalk in a brand new Russian spacesuit. When I unloaded it from a resupply ship, there was a bottle of vodka stuffed in the sleeve. So I would say this, though, is the only place, or my entire time in Russia there and in space, it was the only time that no one cared whether I drank or not. Over in Russia, there's toast for this, toast for that, and if you don't want to partake, it's still sort of the way it was back in the 60s here, where, you know, people hitting you on the back saying, hey, come on, you got to drink, we're all drinking. But up in space with a limited supply, I think my crewmates were glad that I did not partake. But they never got rip-roaring drunk or anything like that. It was more of a after-dinner, try to relax, and before they went to bed. But I didn't like the idea of not being 100% because it was a very dangerous environment up there.
I would imagine being hungover in space would not be pleasant.
I don't think it would be good at all. There's enough space motion sickness going around up there that, you know, you need to adapt to that. That's something you probably don't need. There's a lot of flying up there, too, and drinking and flying don't mix very well. So it's probably not, in my mind, you know, a good idea.
Let's talk about the big fire that nearly destroyed you, your fellow astronauts, and the space station. What caused the fire?
The fire actually originated as a large canister made out of metal, sort of looks like a garbage can, if you will, and it's filled with a slurry of oxygen-rich chemical. I'm in my module typing on a laptop computer up on the ceiling. I hear the blang, blang, blang master alarm going off again. I hit the enter button. I sort of look around, and I'm almost could do diagnoses up there. And I look around, and I notice the walls aren't moving, so I know we haven't lost what's called attitude control. We're not tumbling. I notice my computer's still working. We haven't lost power. I hit the enter button. I push off to go turn the corner to go look at the master alarm panel. Before I can get there, Vasily Sablayev comes flying fast around the corner, and I yell out Seriosny, and he says, Da, ochen pajar. I asked, is it serious? He said, yes, very, fire. He really didn't have to respond because behind him I just saw a big trail of smoke coming, just billowing out of the module. Continue forward, get to the caution and warning panel, look down, looks like a Christmas tree lit up. We've got fire warning lights flashing, smoke warning lights, low voltage lights. I look down the length of the module, sort of like looking down to the back end of a school bus, if you will, and out of that solid fuel oxygen canister is coming a big flame. It's about 3 feet long. Sparks flying out the end of it, smoke billowing out. Within about 30 seconds, I can't see the fingers in front of my face. The smoke was just everywhere, fast. I look down at the hull. It's made out of aluminum. Aluminum's about an eighth of an inch thick, and that's our protection against the vacuum of space. I look down, realize if this blowtorch of a fire points down, it's going to puncture the hull, rapid decompression, quick suffocation. I actually said out loud, I said, not good, were my first words, you know, understatement of my life. Turned back, went to get an oxygen mask, smoke everywhere, can't see the fingers in front of my face. Start feeling my way along the bulkhead, feeling like I'm about 25 meters underwater, no air, feeling lightheaded. Finally locate my personal respirator, grab the rubber mask out, yank it over my head. I activate the oxygen canister by throwing a lever. I breathe in, and I get nothing. Check the position of the lever again. It's set correctly. I breathe in again. Mask collapses around my face. I've got a failed respirator. Throw the mask off. I look around as I'm feeling my way along the wall trying to find a second respirator, and I yell out, actually, I say, Catherine, I love you, to my wife, and I say, I'm really sorry. Looks like I'm not going to make it back.
But you did. You found another respirator.
I did get to a second respirator.
And the fire burned itself out in, what, around 14 minutes?
Well, we went through one fire extinguisher. We went through a second fire extinguisher. I went through a third fire extinguisher. I was heading back for the fourth one. When Vasily yells, fires out, and about 14 minutes of burning, I'll tell you, in a closed space station, 14 minutes is a long time with a flame flying.
What are some of the unique qualities of fire in outer space?
Fire, for one thing, it's not flame-shaped. Warm air doesn't rise, so when a flame burns, the warm air does not rise and fresh air does not come in underneath it. Instead, it burns in its pure state as a sphere, and it will burn up the layer of oxygen around it and put itself out if you're not replenishing that oxygen by blowing a fan on it. Or if the, the other way it can happen, though, the source itself can have oxygen, as in the case of the fire on board that was out of control. That was a oxygen-rich chemical, and it had all the oxygen it needed. But other objects, if you light a piece of paper up there, it will eventually burn the oxygen in the boundary layer around it, and it will put itself out without any effort on your part.
So how much damage was done to the space station by the fire?
The fire melted some of the valves and that behind it. The heat was intense. But as far as anything debilitating and long-term, once we cleaned it up and turned filters back on and swabbed everything down, you don't want the particulates floating because you're going to be breathing them for the next 4 months. Really, the long-term effect of that was negligible.
You couldn't very well get out the smoke by opening up the window.
You goes through your head, I'll tell you, with that flame roaring. I went by a window, and first instinct tells you open a window. Second, you think call 911, get the heck out of here. It gets through your head also. Unfortunately, the rescue vehicle is on the wrong side of the fire, and it's melting metal, and so there's no option to go that direction. But yeah, all those things that, just by instinct, getting low, for example. Immediately I go low to get a gasp of fresh air. Unfortunately, in space, warm air doesn't rise, smoke doesn't rise, smoke is everywhere. So all your earth instincts do not serve you well up there.
Captain Jerry Lininger spent 5 months aboard the space station Mir. It's scheduled to return to Earth early next month. Our interview will continue in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a near collision in space with an unmanned cargo ship traveling at 18,000 miles per hour. We continue our conversation with retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. Anthony Hopkins tells us about creating the role of Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new sequel, Hannibal. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir in 1997 as part of a cooperative mission between the U.S. and Russia. Mir is scheduled to return to Earth early next month after nearly 15 years in orbit. Lininger's book, Off the Planet, has just been published in paperback. I spoke with him last year about life on Mir. Now, you disposed of your trash by doing what?
Well, we would get a resupply ship up there. It looks like a old capsule, like our old Mercury capsule would look like. It's filled with the supplies we need, food, some extra water, spacesuits, whatever we needed, repair parts. After we unloaded it, we would then use it as sort of a garbage truck. And we would take all of our discards and stuff it into that capsule. And it would detach from the space station. The ground would control it, Mission Control in Moscow. They'd fire some thrusters. It would re-enter the atmosphere, burn up, and essentially disintegrate all the garbage.
Now, once after you sent away the Progress filled with your decomposing garbage and broken equipment, Russian ground control told you that it was going to redock with the space station. Why?
The Russians were interested in testing whether we could do a manual docking of this unmanned resupply ship. And that sounds like you can't do that because it's unmanned, but it was a remote control setup where there was a camera inside the capsule and a monitor inside the space station. And so my crewmate Vasily Sublayev would stand there with control sticks, look at the monitor, and would manually fly the spacecraft in as if he were sitting in the spacecraft by looking at the view in the monitor. Unfortunately, the monitor failed, and so you have a spacecraft coming at you at about 18,000 miles an hour that, regardless of how hard we looked, we could not locate. Vasily firing away at the thrusters, trying to break this thing when we finally realized it was coming at us at an uncontrollable speed. Very, very tense moment, sweat pouring from his brow. We'd run back to the window, trying to describe which direction that capsule was going when he would put an impulse in was very difficult because there's nothing else out there, no other objects that you can say, you know, it's going right, left, up, down, because all that is Earth description and it doesn't work in space. So the Progress went zooming by us, missed us by what from our vantage up there looked like a matter of, 10 or 15 meters. And we held our breath as it whizzed by, hoping it wouldn't crash into any of the solar panels or into the hull of the Mir. Very tense moment.
What'd you say to Russian ground control when you survived?
Well, Vasily, the commander, was besides himself. He let the ground know exactly how we felt about an untested procedure, trying to dock this 18,000-mile-an-hour spacecraft sort of in the blind. And that was probably one of the low points of my time up there, actually, the broken trust between what the ground was doing in Moscow and what we cosmonauts and astronauts were trying to do up there in space.
It sounds like on the whole, relations between the astronauts and ground control was not very good.
The relationship was very strained, and it was a matter of, you really have to trust the people on the ground. Again, I got to emphasize the ground in this case was Mission Control Moscow, not Mission Control Houston. And you got the impression that they wanted to keep that space station alive at all costs. And you also had the impression that we as the crew up there better just do exactly what they say, hang in there with that space station again at all costs. And maybe the space station was more important than we were.
Now, you took a five-hour spacewalk when you were aboard the space station Mir. Can you describe what the procedure is? Like, what were you walking on or through?
First of all, walking in space, what an incredible thing. You're essentially a spacecraft. You're out there by yourself, dangling, in my case, on the end of an arm. 18,000 miles an hour, Earth below, the heavens around you, the stars. You see probably four times the number of stars you'd see from the best vantage point on Earth. It's just a, Yahoo feeling of, wow, incredible. And something that, you know, I can look at it, I guess, frame by frame in my mind. You almost don't forget the split second by split second. It's such an incredible, incredible experience. The actual mechanics of it, you climb into the back door of a spacesuit, latch it. As scuba divers know, you're worried about the bends. It's a very similar thing. The spacesuit's going to be at half normal pressure. And so the first thing you do is breathe 100% oxygen to get the nitrogen out of your blood so that you don't get bent when you go out there, which means nitrogen bubbles forming in your arteries and causing physiological problems. Next thing I did is get my two tethers ready. I've got carabiners, if you will, hooks on the end of about a 4-foot rope. I open the hatch up, push it open, and then start being a mountain climber. Start hooking my hooks on exterior parts of the space station, working my way along the surface, dragging a 500-pound experiment behind me as if it weighed nothing.
Now, when you first got outside the spaceship, what did you experience physically?
Physically, you know, it's just the sight is overwhelming just to be out there dangling as an independent spacecraft, and it's just, you know, total uplifting experience. As the spacewalk progressed, I had to climb on the end of an arm. When that arm got swung through open space, I felt the feeling of detachment, felt that I was out there all alone. Spacecraft, as I look back, you know, space station mirror is looking like a tinker toy, and I had a feeling of total detachment, and it also hit me gut level. I felt the speed. I felt 18,000 miles an hour, and I felt as if I was falling off a cliff, just screaming with speed. And I did what I think 99% of the people of the world would do. You know, I just grabbed on for dear life, white-knuckled terror, you know, fear, overwhelming, and mumbled to myself, not good again, which was one of my expressions I used a lot on Mir. You know, and then I told myself, hey, I got 5 hours of work to do. I've been training on the bottom of swimming pools for the last 6 months before the flight, and I'm going to get this job done somehow. I tricked myself. What I did, I looked down at the earth. I looked back up again. I said, Adin, Dva, Tri, Chitiri, Pyat, counted to five in Russian, looked back down at the earth. And I said, Jerry, it's okay to be falling at 18,000 miles an hour as long as you don't hit the bottom. And rationally, I knew I was in orbit. I was going 18,000 miles an hour, but we were going to keep orbiting. I wasn't going to hit the earth. I took the fear, tucked it away in a compartment of my brain that I was glad I had. Let go my grip and got swung out and continued with my job.
Did it feel good after this exhilarating but frightening 5-hour mission to get back into the Mir?
It's with some regrets. It felt good to get back in. I'll tell you, though, on the end of the arm, on the way back, I swung out. I had that feeling of overwhelming fear, overcame it, went and did the job. I got swung back in the other direction, same point in space, same sensation. This time I just yelled out, Yahoo. I attached myself with my tethers and carabiners, pushed myself off, dangled, and said, my God, this is incredible. You know, a ride at Disneyland. There's nothing like this. When I got back inside, closed the hatch, got out of the suit, it was a good feeling of accomplishment, which I will tell you is what kept you going on Space Station Mir, that sense of accomplishment that you're getting something done that's worthwhile, you're out there colonizing space. That's what gets you through the hard times.
Well, you couldn't exactly celebrate afterwards with a hearty meal.
No, but I did suck down some dehydrated, you know, mashed potatoes. And my favorite out of a tube is the Russian, you know, jellied piked perch. If you want to try a real delicacy, Tara, that's what you want, jellied piked perch. I mean, sucked out of a tube. You know, I won't go near that stuff again in my life. But up there, anything was fine, and, you know, it's okay. But you get done with that spacewalk. I went back to my module. I actually wrote a letter to my son, John. He was 1 year old, and along the way I decided that, you know, it's important to let your sons and daughters know what you're doing in life and that you love them and what you stand for. What you hope and dream for them. And I wrote him a note that night, and I said, John, your dad has courage. Letting go of that pole, when I was going 18,000 miles an hour and feeling the speed, that took courage. Got to my wall, strapped myself on, closed my eyes, slept like a baby.
Wow. My guest is retired American astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space center Mir. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is retired American astronaut Jerry Lininger. He spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir as part of a joint Russian-American mission. You returned to Earth from the space station Mir on the space shuttle with American astronauts. Would you describe what you experienced physically after 5 months in space, re-entering the Earth's atmosphere on the space shuttle?
Reentry itself is just phenomenal, and it boggles the mind what we can do when human beings collectively set their minds to something. Mission Control Houston is controlling at that point, of course. We're in shuttle. We're over Australia. We flipped the shuttle upside down, inverted engines pointed in the direction we're flying, the direction of the velocity vector. They give you the go for deorbit burns. You fire the engines. You feel the shudder, you flip yourself back over, you start plunging through the atmosphere, big fireball all around you, bouncing up and down, just a wild ride all the way in. If you don't like turbulence in an airplane, you would not like re-entry in the shuttle. It is the ultimate turbulence. You're just plunging through that atmosphere. Myself, people are very concerned. Astronaut before me said he felt like he weighed 2,000 pounds on landing, couldn't lift his arms off the mid-deck floor. Russians routinely, they reach into the capsule, pull them out after 4 or 5 months in space, plop them on a bed, roll them into the medical tent. So during that re-entry, I'm getting calls from the ground, how you doing in the mid-deck, Jerry? I'm moving my hand up and down. I'm actually feeling pretty good, dropping my ink pen a lot because I'm used to it floating as I set it out there. But lifting my arms and they're feeling very, very heavy, but nonetheless, pure joy, exhilaration. I'm heading home. Charlie in the flight deck yells out, Jerry, tally ho, West Coast. And I'll tell you, it just feels good to be over the U.S. again. Serious calls come in. How you doing? I say, hey, I'm doing great. It feels good to be home. 5 months.
Were you able to, stand up and walk out of the capsule?
Well, the shuttle does its final turn, which is a manual one. We do the landing, rollout, deceleration. They open that hatch. I'll tell you, that air comes in. After 5 months of breathing air made out of urine, maybe that's why it was so wonderful. You know, the fresh earth air hits you, and my God, it's just, it just tastes good. Flight surgeon comes on board, says, Jerry, we got two guys out here, stretcher. You can sit here for an hour, 2 hours, whatever you need. We'll come get you when you're ready. And I said, Tom, you know, I've been in space for 5 months, overcome a lot of difficulties, started something. I'm going to finish it. I'm an officer in the United States Navy, and we don't get carried off on stretchers. And I'm going to walk off this thing, or I'm going to crawl off this thing. But please don't touch me. Stood up. Tell you, my chest started heaving like I've never felt it. My vision started going gray, closing in, felt like I'm pulling too many G's in an F-14 or something. About to black out, and right at that moment, my chest kicks into a gear I didn't know I have. Remember what gravity's all about. Pump the blood back up to my brain, open my vision back up. Shuffled forward, and I'm sure I wasn't walking pretty, but I was on my own 2 feet. 90-degree turn, climbed over Mount Everest, which was actually my seat, about foot high. Felt like Mount Everest. Felt like you were sitting on my shoulders. Crawled out the side hatch. Two big guys there with a stretcher, surprised to see me. Said, welcome back, Captain Lininger. I shook their hands, told them, man, it's great to be back. Walked away. They did a couple claps for me. Said, you make us proud, Captain Lininger. And it felt good to be on my own 2 feet. And walking again.
Jerry Lininger, thank you so much for sharing some of your experiences and perceptions with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
Captain Jerry Liniger spent 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. It's scheduled to return to Earth early next month. Liniger's book, Off the Planet, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year.
Dear Clarice, I have followed with enthusiasm the course of your disgrace and public shaming. My own never bothered me except for the inconvenience of being incarcerated. But you may lack perspective. In our discussions down in the dungeon, it was apparent to me that your father, the dead night watchman, figures largely in your value system.
Anthony Hopkins is back as Dr. Hannibal Lecter in the new film Hannibal. It also stars Julianne Moore in the role of FBI agent Clarice Starling. I spoke with Hopkins in 1991 when he played Lecter in Jonathan Demme's film The Silence of the Lambs. His chilling performance won him an Academy Award as Best Actor. In The Silence of the Lambs, Dr. Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter is in prison for committing a series of grisly murders and eating some of his victims. He carries out his beastly actions with exquisite manners. He chooses a fine Chianti while dining on the liver of one of his victims. Throughout the film, he taunts FBI agent Starling, played in the 1991 film by Jodie Foster, who's desperately trying to track down another serial killer.
I'll help you catch him, Clary.
You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, Doctor.
All good things to those who wait. I've waited, Clary, but how long can you and old Jackie boy wait? Our little Billy must already be searching for that next special lady.
Hopkins portrays a highly educated madman. I asked him how he came up with the character's voice.
When I was assured that the part was on offer to me, I started to work on it and simply to learn the lines and think about it. And it was such a well-written part, and the story was so compelling, that when I, after the first reading, I heard the voice of Hannibal Lecter. It sort of, I heard it in my head, I saw a vision of it, I saw what he looked like. Well, not strictly within the first reading, but let's say maybe two or three readings of the script. Because my work is kind of quite simple. I just learn it, you know, before I start filming. Just learn the text, learn the words. And the voice came. And for some reason, I don't know why, the voice, in fact, identified the character for me, and I saw within a few more days what he looked like, the hair being slicked back and the way he moved, his grace and elegance.
Describe what you did with your voice.
Well, it was there was one line which I think you've seen on the trailers, and I said, I'll help you catch him, Clarice. I don't know what it was. It was just a kind of tone, and there's a speech where he says, one of the speeches that made me understand man was, he said, you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube, a well-scrubbed hustling rube with a little taste. And I thought, that's it, that's the character.
You know, there's something both very effete, very scary, and very purring about the voice.
Yes.
Well,
the thing is, if you're playing an evil character, if you're playing somebody who's mad or evil.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's say, just take the first part. If you're playing somebody who's mad, the thing is not to play him mad, but to play the opposite. Play him as ultra sane. If you're playing somebody who's evil, play the good side of him. And that makes him more scary because you humanize him. Because nobody is all evil. Nobody is all good. Whatever those terms mean, but nobody is all one thing. So what I do as an actor is to find out what the other side of the character is. And I found out with Lecter that, in fact, I think his problem is, or his peculiar psychology is, that he is so in control of himself, mentally, spiritually, physically, whichever way, he's so totally in control of every aspect of his thinking that he is completely mad, because nobody can be in that much control. It's as if he is so sane, he's flipped over into the world of the dark and the irrational.
No, I don't know if this is connected to the control you see the characters having, but you rarely blink in the movie. I mean, the eyes have a fixed stare and they're wide open all the time.
Yes. Well, I don't know. I didn't analyze much about the part. I mean, I just had a hunch on how to play him. First of all, when you're playing a character like this, you have to like him. The actor has to somehow like him. And I think there's something very terrifying about people who are unblinking. It's that they are so certain. They have no doubts, no uncertainty. And they're so certain that makes them terrifying. If you look at all the great monstrous political leaders in our century, you know.
One of which you've played.
Yes. Yes. Old Adolf, yes. They rise to power because they're so certain, they have no doubts. Their minds already made up. Somebody said of Hitler, a journalist who interviewed Hitler in 1936, before the war, she said, Hitler has in his library 1,000 books. He hasn't read any one of them, but of course he doesn't need to because his mind is already made up. And I found that the most apocalyptic, frightening vision of a man. And I think it's the same with Lecter. He knows with absolute certainty what he is and what everyone else is around him.
Anthony Hopkins recorded in 1991 when The Silence of the Lambs was released. Coming up, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews the sequel, Hannibal. This is Fresh Air. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review of Hannibal, the new sequel to The Silence of the Lambs. Hannibal stars Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter and Julianne Moore as FBI agent Clarice Starling, the role originated by Jodie Foster. Hannibal was directed by Ridley Scott.
Whether we're talking about the movie or the lip-smacking Midwestern cannibal, Hannibal is dull and gross. Using the crude technique pioneered by William Friedkin in The Exorcist, director Ridley Scott leads us through acres of barren exposition with only brief stops at oases of blood and gore. So Hannibal is an unworthy successor to the extravagantly overpraised Silence of the Lambs. Despite being morally slippery and stylistically overdrawn, that movie at least had a keen sense of structure. Young FBI agent Clarice Starling, on the track of a serial killer, had to split her time between two storylines. In one, she pursued a sexually perverse madman who had kidnapped a politician's daughter. In the second, she confronted Hannibal Lecter, an imprisoned cannibalistic killer who, in a cat-and-mouse game, gave her insight into the mind of her quarry. Hannibal may have been written by David Mamet and Oscar-winning Steven Zaillian, but structurally, it's a mess. The action opens with Agent Starling, now played by a prissy Julianne Moore instead of an ice-cold Jodie Foster, supervising a deadly botched drug bust. Her superiors, who are manipulated by an evil billionaire, both censure her and put her back on the trail of the escaped Lecter. On the trail, though, means sitting in a basement for much of the movie, watching old videotapes. Lecter, meanwhile, is in Florence, flouncing around under a pseudonym and angling for a job at a classics library. These sequences, in which director Scott shows off his talents for turning any street corner into a dramatic forum, are supposed to be a showcase for Anthony Hopkins. After all, much of the movie is constructed around, and the advertising campaign relies upon, Hopkins' reprised performance as the lip-smacking Lecter. The Florence sequences don't really have anything to do with the rest of the movie. Starling eventually figures out that Lecter is there, but mostly the killer toys with a crooked Italian police detective, played by a still gauntly handsome Giancarlo Giannini. But this focus on Hopkins only exposes his shortcomings. Whatever he was in Silence of the Lambs, Lecter is now more movie monster than human. He dresses and acts theatrically, and he doesn't just speak a line, but purrs, murmurs, declaims, or accuses with brio. He's a first cousin to a road company Phantom of the Opera. In this scene, Lecter gloats over Giannini as he shows him a gruesome Renaissance painting of a hanging.
Oh, I should have shown them this one. I can't imagine how I missed it. Mama, I told you about it. It's a rendering I found in the Capone Library. Can you make it out? There's a name there. The one I told you about. Ancestor Commendatore, hanging beneath these very windows, Francesca de Pazzi. On a related subject, I must confess to you, I'm giving very serious thought. To eating your wife.
The giveaway is that whenever Hopkins stops talking, the already obtrusive music wells up. Visually, Hopkins is even more at sea. As he strides through Florence, his round, ruddy face adorned with an oversized Borsellino, his stocky body encased in a billowing cape-like coat, he looks like nothing so much as a happily tipsy tourist who has just been mugged by a boutique sales staff. Through creaky contrivance, Starling and Lecter do finally get to duel face-to-face, but by then the movie is dragging so much that the filmmakers begin emergency injections of gore. None of this amounts to much. It's too bad, because Silence of the Lambs did pick up on the whiff of terrifying perversity between Starling and Lecter. The two enacted the bond between a sexually abusive adult and a grown-up victim of child abuse, a tense and terrifying relationship. But though Moore is generally a terrific actress, as Starling she gets lost in fussy and self-conscious display. When she and Hopkins get together at the climax for a dinner of living human brain, there's no sense of emotional bondage to accompany the grotesquerie. The overwhelming sensation is of futility, of a bad hand played out to its last card, a joker.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Division, publisher of Total Memory Workout, 8 Easy Steps to Maximum Memory Fitness by Cynthia R. Green. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When day is done and shadows fall, I dream of you.
That's singer Mildred Bailey. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Will Friedwald, who wrote the extensive liner notes to a new 10-CD collection of her work. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Without you, night has lost its charms. When day is done, grass is wet with twilight dew. My lonely heart is sinking with the sun.